Yeshus of the Axelrod, the Weider Rabbanim, Ms. Dreyer, who really want to acknowledge her efforts as well, coordinating this program. She also chose the topic, and I just want to wish that she should continue to be a wonderful ambassador for our REITs and for Yeshiva University, and all your efforts should be crowned with success, B'liyai and Hara. Many decades ago, an ophthalmologist who was an acquaintance of mine was just getting started in his practice. One day, an elderly Jewish woman came into his office and reported frantically that her neighbor had given her a canary, and ever since she had had no end of problems with her eyesight. The doctor was baffled. What connection could there possibly be between her neighbor's canary and the maladies with which his patient was now suffering? Finally, the mystery was solved. The woman's neighbor, she believed, had given her an ayin hara. The term canine hara had evolved into, as in the lingo of many Americans at the time, into canary. What emerges, though, is that the belief in the power of an ayin hara to cause all manners of illness, and perhaps particularly with respect to one's eyes, was quite commonly and firmly held, and especially by people whose levels of religious observance was not always of the highest order. I imagine if we took a poll in the room here, we'd get a range of approaches. What is our reaction when we hear about ayin hara? Do we look at it as a force to be reckoned with, constantly feared, worrying about it? The kinds of ornaments that we try to get to ward off ayin hara, the ubiquitous chamsa, the red ribbon, and even those who don't take ayin hara that seriously will often find ourselves in one way or another, you know, tampering our remarks with, you know, B'li ayin hara, ken ayin hara. I once remember seeing a license plate of a car in front of me on the highway, which was ken ayin hara. On the other hand, I'm sure there are people who would completely dismiss the belief in ayin hara as naive superstition and primitive insecurity. So what do our chazal have to say about ayin hara? I'd like to divide the talk into four parts. I'd like to first present a survey, not a full survey, but something of a survey of statements in Chazal, which, as we will see, affirm unequivocally the belief in the concept of ayin hara. Next, I'd like to mention several theories, from the rational to the mystical, that appear in rabbinic literature over the ages to explain the phenomenon. Third, I'd like to, the bulk of this year will be to look at a number of halachic rulings that are rooted in the concept of ayin hara, and then, time permitting, to touch briefly on the notion of strategies for warding off the ayin hara and perhaps developing immunity to its potentially deleterious effects. So let's begin with the approach in general of Chazal to ayin hara. You have the source sheets in front of you. That the sages of the Talmud took the existence of ayin hara for granted becomes quickly apparent to anyone who scans the corpus of the relevant sources. The notion of ayin hara, or simply the ayin, as it's sometimes known, is a recurrent theme in Chazal and appears in numerous forms and contexts. Sometimes the ayin hara takes the form of a curse bestowed by someone who feels slighted or embittered. Twice, the rabbis attribute to a matriarch Sarah an ayin hara with varying effects. First, as noted in source number one, because of Sarah's ayin hara, Hagar, the maidservant of Avram, miscarried soon after she had conceived. And later, when Hagar is evicted from Avram's house in Parshas Vayera, and this time Yishmael was already older, according to the Medrash, although he was able to walk by then, he suddenly became crippled due to Sarah's ayin hara, and this required that he was carried on his mother's shoulder. Similarly, the Gemara records numerous instances in which the negative glances of certain rabbis were the catalyst for death of those who aroused their ire or envy. Nasan enabo v'nase gal shalatzamos. Sometimes even the deaths of several rabbis are attributed to the effects of such an ayin hara. And in such a case, Chazal, the Gemara suggests that the harsh effects of the evil eye were a consequence of the greatness of the individuals who inflicted it. Kol makom shenasnu chachamim einehem, o misa, o oni. Chazal recommend that one do whatever is possible to avoid arousing the envy of others. For example, on the pasuk in Parshas Miketz, Vayom Yaakov levanav lama tisra'u, the Gemara in Tainis comments, and Rashi quotes this as well, Al taru atzmechem kishatem siveyim bifnei Esav, bifnei Yishmael, kidei shilo yiskanu bachem. Don't make yourself appear satiated. There was a famine, but they still had food. Yaakov's children still had food. Don't appear to be satiated in the eyes of the neighbors so that they not become envious of you. Apropos to this Gemara, it's also worth mentioning that the Gemara mentions at the end of Bava Basra and also in Sanhedrin that it's human nature for a person to present himself as poorer than really are. Adam asui shelo hasbia es atzmo. To avoid ayin hara, the Medrash Tanchuma notes further that Yaakov instructed his sons, this is in Source 6, quoted by Rashi, that when they go down to Egypt, to Mitzrayim, they should do so inconspicuously through 10 separate entrances, lishbor b'soch haba'im, so as not to draw attention to themselves. The reason is they were all very handsome and they didn't want to arouse the attention of those natives in Mitzrayim. The rabbis often emphasize that the more public an endeavor, the less likely it is to succeed. Thus, Chazal tell us in the Gemara Tainis, and also in Bamitsiya, Membeis, Ein Habracha Mitsuya, Ela Bedavar Hasamway Min Ha'ayin. Blessing is only found in that which is hidden from the public eye. Simply understood, that's because when something is hidden from public view, it is not subject to the forces of Ayin Hara, and so can experience blessing. The Gemara observes in Psachim Daf Nun, source number 8, that certain people and professions are less likely to succeed because of their being constantly subjected to ayin hara. Tanu rabbanon hamistaker bekanim ubekankanim. Somebody who trades in cane and jars, eino roi simon bracha ga'olam, will not succeed. The reason is kim nafish atazayu shotabu eina, because the bulk is very large, and so people think they must be wealthy, and so they're not going to succeed. They'll be ayin hara. The Gemara continues, Tagore simta, ligadle behemadaka, the coach of say Ilonus Tovos, Venosnim Emehem Bechilek Yafe. Traders in the market stands who do their business outdoors, those who breed small cattle that bother the neighbors, those who cut down beautiful trees to sell for timber, and those who, when dividing up shears, cast their eyes upon the better portion, the pie is divided, and you reach for the biggest piece. All of the above, eino roa simon bracha la'olam, will not succeed. The reason is, maitaima detahu bei inshi. People wonder about them. Even a spiritual endeavor, when engaged as a public spectacle, is vulnerable to the deleterious effects of ayin hara. In this regard, the rabbis highlight the difference between the first and second luchos. The first luchos, whose presentation was accompanied by much ado and fanfare, was tragically shattered. By contrast, Moshe Rabbeinu's ascent to Har Sinai to receive the second luchos was done in a private fashion, without ceremony or fanfare, as it says, "V'ish lo yale imach," and because of that, they remained intact. Even the Mishkan, the sanctuary used by the Bnei Yisrael during the sojourn in the Midbar, required, according to the Medrash, source number 10, its own special protection from Ayin Hara in the form of Birchas Kohanim, V'yishmerecha me'ayin hara. That's why in Parshas Naso you'll find Birchas Kohanim juxtaposed with the description of the dedication of the Mishkan. How prevalent was Ayin Hara thought to be? There is a fascinating passage in the Gemara in Bava Metzia, Kuf Zayin on the Bay, source number 11, which cites the interpretation of Rav on the pasuk in Parshas Ekev. Behesir Hashem imcha kol choli. Hashem remove from you all illness. Amar Rav zu ayin. The expression all illness is a reference to a single factor that contributes to all illness, namely the evil eye. The Gemara relates that Rav arrived at this conclusion after visiting the cemetery and discovering that 99 out of 100 deaths were the result of Ayin Hara. Tishin b'tisha v'ayin ra v'echad b'derech eretz. Parenthetically, the Yerushalmi in Shabbos notes that this observation held true only in Bavel, where Rav lived, because it was in that country that the force of Ayin Hara were thought to be especially prevalent. But Eretz Yisrael wasn't that bad. How does it work? We've seen a small sample of sources in rabbinic literature for the notion of Ayin Hara. How does this phenomenon work? Now, the concept of Ayin Hara seems to rest on two assumptions. First, that injury or damage can be triggered as a result of a person's thoughts or a person's gaze. Second assumption, the more public something is, the more likely it is to be affected by Ayin Hara. What is the engine that so empowers the evil eye? The answer is not explicitly articulated in the Gemara, and various theories have been put forward over the centuries to fill the gap. Although I should mention that no single explanation would plausibly account for all the different examples that we've said. So to proceed to some of the most prominent explanations. The Zohar and others after him, the Chidah and others, refer to the power of the evil eye as an all-encompassing negative energy nourished by the Sitra Achara, the forces of evil. There's a medieval work, Shelos Etshuvos Min HaShamayim, one of the Balei Tosfos, Rabbi Yaakov Amaves of France, who explains that certain individuals whose lives are controlled by a particular constellation are born with a greater ability to inflict harm through the evil eye than the average person. Rabbi Yitzchak Aramav, the Golden Age of Spain, describes Ayin Hara as a psychic imbalance which causes the body to release toxic forces by way of the eye that wreaks havoc on its surroundings. Parshas Tazria and Akedas Yitzchak, Rabbeinu Yonah and Avos mention something along those lines as well. Rabbeinu Yonah adds another component, as does the Maral in his Sefer Nesivos Olam, and they emphasize the emotional component. That is, that one who is consumed by character flaws, such as envy and hatred, possesses psychic energy which can bring physical harm to others as well as to oneself. And sometimes it actually backfires. In modern times, Rav Dessler of the 20th century proposes a novel theory, and there's evidence of this in other sources as well, that the power of the Ayin Hara stems from the interconnection of souls on their most pristine level. When an individual feels threatened by another's reality and negates it in their mind, wishing that person away, actually weakens the life force of that person and makes them vulnerable. And elsewhere, Rav Dessler suggests in a different fashion that when one is aroused by envy, a prosecuting complaint is lodged in heaven, a kitrug, as to whether that person is indeed worthy of that good fortune, that person in some way aroused the envy of someone else, and so they revisit whether that person really deserves it, and sometimes that could rescind the blessing. Rav Kasher, also of the 20th century, suggests that the power of Ayin Hara might be understood in light of modern scientific discoveries such as mental imagery and hypnosis, which prove that mere thoughts are capable of altering physical realities. It's interesting in this regard to note that the Baruch Sha'amar, the author of the Torah Tamima, who wrote a sefer in Chumash Tosefes Bracha, records in Parshas Balak from a newspaper in 1881, I don't know, Mir Ilustruwani, I can't really pronounce it, about a particular experiment that was done then, Russian newspaper, that individual who was slated to be killed, and they wanted to see the results of this experiment. They took this person and they deprived him of food for several days, after which they put in his sight of vision, but beyond his reach, a loaf of bread, so that the person could only look at the bread but couldn't actually bring it to eat it. And afterwards they cut the bread up and they saw it was filled with poison, whatever you'll say it is exactly scientifically, but they could only attribute that reality to the fact that this person was looking at it, staring at it, wanting it so much but wasn't able to eat it. And he uses that story to illustrate the power of Ayin Hara. The Chazon Ish refers to the power of Ayin Hara as a manifestation of what he calls Sodos Habriya, secrets of creation, in which a person's mental energy can have a destructive effect on something in the physical world. Whenever people get overly excited about a successful reality, they endanger that very reality. Lukutim Techoshe Mishpat in Chazon Ish. But the Chazon Ish goes on to address a fundamental theological issue related to this. And that is, where does Ayin Hara fit within the scheme of Hashgacha Pratis, divine providence? In other words, if a person was not destined to experience a particular loss, how could the effects of Ayin Hara override that? And the Chazon Ish answers that oftentimes when it has been ordained that a person should suffer a certain loss, a situation is created whereby the Ayin Hara becomes the immediate catalyst that sets things into motion. In the case of Rav, who we noted 99 out of 100 people in the cemetery died because of Ayin Hara, it most certainly would have been decreed the previous Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that they would die. But the immediate cause of their death was the Ayin Hara. And the same can be said about the various rabbis in the Gemara who were adversely affected by the Ayin Hara of their colleagues. Okay, says the Chazon Ish, if so, why bother taking precautions for Ayin Hara? If it's destined, it's destined. To which he says that exposure to Ayin Hara is deemed a state of danger, necessitating a measure of extra merit to withstand Ayin Hara's effects. Sometimes the specific decree of Yom Kippur will dictate that should an individual find themselves in such a circumstance, they will not be saved by divine intervention. And therefore, it's up to a person to avoid placing themselves in Ayin Hara danger in the same way that one would avoid potential situations of recognized physical danger. There's obviously a lot more to say about this, but I think the issue is very, very intriguing and very important. But what I'd like to do for most of the rest of the time is to focus on halachos that are connected to the premise of Ayin Hara. I'd like to begin with the notion of taking a census. There's a common, well-known practice of avoiding outright headcounts when checking whether you have a minyan in shul. So instead, we typically take a 10-word pasuk, like Hoshia Samecha Vorechis Nachlasecha. The earliest source for avoiding direct headcounts is a pasuk in Parashas Kisisa, where the Torah tells us Kisisa's Rosh Bnei Yisrael of Kudehem, V'nasnu Ishko for Nafshel Hashem Bifkodosam. Everybody is to give a half shekel, and you count the half shekel coins, and then you know how many Jews there are. Rashi comments on that pasuk in source 12, It says, "V'lo yeh bahem negef." If you do this, there won't be a plague. So Rashi explains, "Shaminyan sholei bo ayin hara v'hadever bo aleihem kimosha morfina b'mei David." That if you would do a head count, a normal head count, it would lead to a plague because of the effects of ayin hara. The Gemara tells us in Yuma, Daf Chav Beis, source 13, "Amar Rabbi Yitzchak asa limnos es Yisrael afilu ledvar mitzvah." One is not allowed to count Jews even for the purpose of a mitzvah. The Gemara derives this from the fact that before doing battle, Shaul HaMelech conducted a census of his troops in an indirect fashion, either through the use of shards of clay or of animals. And the Gemara also makes reference to a pasuk in Hosea in Perek Beis, "V'haya mispar b'nei Yisrael k'chol hayom, asher lo yimad v'lo yisafer." Jews should not be counted. The Gemara connects it also to a Mishnah that discusses a lottery that took place among the Kohanim in the Beis HaMikdash, which was done via a hat count rather than the head count. The commentaries actually asked why the Gemara didn't quote the pasuk in Parsha Ki Sisa that we mentioned earlier, and there are a couple of answers that are suggested. One is that the Gemara was discussing a census of a small portion of the population, whereas the pasuk in Ki Sisa is referring to a census of the entire Jewish people. And another possible answer has to do with the fact that the Gemara emphasizes even when the census is itself for a mitzvah, like in the case of Shaul, who was waging war. But what is wrong with a direct census? The answer is, "V'lo yevahem negef bivkodosan," as Rashi taught us, the fear of ayin hara. When you take every individual and highlight them for themselves, this raises the risk of ayin hara. The practice of using a 10-word pasuk when counting for a minyan goes back as far as the Gaonic period. There's a responsa of Rav Hai Gaon, as well as in the Sefer Ha'orah of Rashi, source 14, and the preferred pasuk there was not Hoshea es Amecha, but in a pasuk which is quite appropriate for coming to shul to daven, namely, "V'ani b'rov chastecha avo v'secha, eshtachale elhecha katshecha v'yirasecha." And the way that it was done, as you can see in source 14, is not that the gabbai or one individual would go one by one and say each word of the pasuk, but everyone would participate. So pasachad v'ani. One person in the corner of the room would start to say v'ani, and the one next to him would say v'rov, and the third person chasdecha, and if you got to the tenth person to say v'yirasecha, you know that you had a minion. And it's quite interesting, if we get to this later, there are all kinds of psukim that have been quoted as psukim that are meant to protect from ayin hara, and it so happens this pasuk is quoted as well, "V'ani b'rov chastecha avo v'secha." The prohibition of counting Jews is not cited explicitly in Shulchan Aruch, but is quoted by the Magen Avraham, as well as the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. And this, of course, raises the issue whenever a census is conducted in Eretz Yisrael. I don't know when the last one was. It was one in 72 and 83, and I'm sure since then. But all kinds of tshuvos, responsa appear, which address whether it's allowed and how it could be allowed. Rabbi Bleich has some wonderful essays in his work, Contemporary Halachic Problems, and many of the poskim permit it on the grounds that it's a written census, and that would be considered something of an indirect counting. I'd like to turn to another issue in halacha, which is based on the notion of ayin hara, and that is what's called hezek re'iyah. There is a prohibition to gaze at another's field at the time that its produce is in full bloom. Aser la'adam la'amod b'stei chavero b'sha shehi omedes b'kamuleha. It's interesting that the author of the statement is Rav, who we mentioned earlier, is the one who made that observation about 99 out of 100 people being affected by ayin hara. So he says that one is not allowed to gaze at another person's field when things are in full bloom. The Aruch HaShulchan in the 19th century, others discuss this as well, someone causes damage to another person's field and what's growing because of ayin hara, do they have to pay for damages? So the Aruch HaShulchan says that you don't have to pay in Beis Din, Shalmata. The court of law can't force you to pay because this is not something that you can directly attribute in the most obvious way to ayin hara, but there would be a moral obligation to pay according to the heavenly tribunal and the standards of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There is a halachic concept known as hezek re'iya, visual damage. The Gemara tells us in Bava Basra that it's prohibited for a person to open a new window opposite another person's window because of what's called hezek re'iya, visual trespass, visual damage. The Ramban, source 16, points out that hezek re'iya has three components. And one of them is ayin hara. Ayin ra, lishna bisha, lashon hara, gossip, what you see, we'll talk about, sniusa, an invasion of privacy. But one of the considerations is actually ayin hara. The Gemara in the beginning of Bava Basra cites a disagreement as to whether partners in a courtyard who are in the process of disbanding their partnership can compel one another to share in the cost of constructing a 4 amos, 4 cubit high fence, which will ensure their respective privacy rights in the courtyard. The issue hinges on the question of whether hezek re'iya shmei hezek or not, whether visual damage constitutes damage, in which case there will be a legal claim to force the construction of a fence, or if hezek re'iya lo shmei hezek, no legal obligation exists. But then the Gemara points out that even according to the latter opinion, the hezek re'iya lo shmei hezek, that's true in the case of a courtyard. In the case of a garden, there's a legally enforceable requirement to construct a fence. The reason for the distinction is because the visual damage of a garden is thought to be greater than that of a courtyard, in line with the prohibition that Rav taught us of gazing at another's field while the produce is in full bloom. So most halachic authorities rule that in the case of two partners dividing a garden, a 4 amos high fence must be constructed with the cost borne by both parties. So we see here that the principle of ayin hara may carry an actionable legal claim in a court of Jewish law. But it is interesting to note that the Rambam in Surah 17, Rambam in Hilchos Shechinim, feels that there's no requirement to erect a 4 cubit high fence to prevent the peeping toms, even in the case of a garden. What's necessary is only to put up a small marker fence of 10 tefachim, which will prevent trespassing. And many asked the Rambam in writing, why did he feel this way? And the Rambam explains that the prohibition against gazing at another's field while in full bloom was a matter of midas chassid, this higher ethical standard. Apparently, as Matthias Yosh Drashen points out in his classes to Bava Basra, the Rambam did not view ayin hara as having the potential to cause actual damage, and he suggests that this is consistent with the Rambam's overall approach to dismiss or play down all kinds of quasi-mystical notions that are mentioned in the Gemara. So perhaps, according to the Rambam, much of what we have said so far may not be, in fact, to be taken literally. But there is certainly an issue of one's personal ethics and as the Midas Chassidus for yourself. It's not appropriate to steer at someone else's field when things are growing, but that's not a matter of causing actual damage. The Machaber in Shulchan Aruch actually quotes two opinions on the question whether you have to have a 4 amos fence in the case of a garden or the 10 tefachim fence. Another halachic issue which is connected to ayin hara comes up when you have in shul, for example, a family simcha, and you have a lot of relatives that you want to give kibudim to for aliyos. And the question is, can you call up two brothers, one after the other, or a father and a son, for consecutive aliyos? And you'll see in Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber tells us in Source 19, that really there's no problem. Yicholim likros beis achim zeach hazeva bein achar ha'ad. You can have one brother and the other, or a father and a son. However, ein manichim ela b'shvil ayin hara. We don't generally condone it, even though it's permitted, because of ayin hara, to have them right after the other, two people of the same family, even if one is shvi and one is maftir, lo yikru asheni b'shmo mishum ayin hara. There are a lot of details in this issue, and Mishnah Brura and many others deal with questions such as, suppose the two brothers tell us, we don't believe in ayin hara, we go with the Rambam, let's say, we're not concerned, we want back-to-back aliyos. Should that make a difference? Most poskim say it doesn't matter. Here and there, you find The Aruch HaShulchan thinks maybe it would be okay. If the second person was already called up, the second brother or the son after the father, now what? May he go ahead and make the bracha, or, sorry, he has to step down and give someone else the chance. What if the second Aliyah was a special maftir in a second Sefer Torah? Would that matter? Or is it only if the maftir is of the same reading of the same Torah? What about Hagbaglila? If you have two brothers or father and a son for Hagbaglila, I remember many years ago I had a shul and I had this question. I asked Rabbi David Feinstein, who told me not to worry about it. Hagbaglila, no problem. You can have two brothers do it. Maybe others are machmir, but there are definitely many who are mekel. How about a grandfather and a grandson? Mishnevor mentions that case as well. So there are a lot of issues for Gaboyim to consider in terms of this halacha. I want to turn to another area, and that is the notion of a double chasana, you could say, or a double bris. In other words, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch in Evan HaEzer, source 20, Rav Yosef Cairo says that if you have two chasanim, now each one has their chuppah, their own chuppah, and they do what they have to do to betroth the woman, and now you're going to do the birchas nisuin, the seven brachos under the chuppah. Do you have to do seven brachos for chasan A, and a separate seven brachos for chasan B, or can you just have whoever's Messiah the Kedushin who's present say the seven brachos and accounts for both chasanim? So the Shulchan Aruch says, no problem. It's not an issue of Ein Osin, Mitzvahs Chavilos, Chavilos for various reasons. It's not a problem that Imar and Simcha B'Simcha, as discussed by the Poskim. And therefore, there's really no issue. You can have the seven, you have to do a separate chuppah, but you can have the seven brachos said by one individual on behalf of both chasanim. However, the Ramah disagrees. The Ramah says at the end of Source 20, Yesh omim de'en levarech de'beis chasanim biyachad mishum ayin hara, that the concern of ayin hara dictates that you should have a separate sheva brachos recited under each chuppah for each chasan. It's interesting that you have another case in Yerudea Hilchos Milah, Source 21, where the Mechaber tells us if you have two babies, do brisan, it could be twins, for example. So you know we have to make a bracha al hamila before, and there's another bracha that's said after the bris, which is Ashekida Shidid Mibetan, and we end Kores Habris. The Mechaber says that you can do one bracha, the al hamila, to cover for both babies, and then you can have the Ashekida Shidid Mibetan said after the second bris and covering both babies as well. But in this case, the Ramah did not comment that one shouldn't do it because of ayin hara. So the post can wonder, apparently if the Ramah had been concerned about ayin hara because it would arouse attention in doing the one set of sheva brachas for two chasanim, you should have said the same thing in the case of the bris. And others say that the Taz, for example, says that there may be a distinction because the chasanim have to be present at the time of the sheva brachos. The baby, once you did the bris of the two babies, one baby, both babies can be taken out to the next room and you can continue to do the bracha shakidash, so you don't have to have the babies there. Maybe that's why the Ramah didn't feel that it's necessarily a concern of ayin hara. There's another gemara which I don't have in your sheet that has to do with an individual who's watching a garment. Not the person lost something and you're Shomer Aveda, you're watching it for the rightful owner, and meanwhile guests come, and typically you might want to spread it out because it airs out the garment, but not when you have guests coming because they can look at it and they can damage it with Ayin Hara. It's another application of Ayin Hara in Halacha. There are a number of customs attributed to Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, the medieval pietist, that are based on Ayin Hara. For example, Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid forbids two brothers from marrying two sisters. He also says that a chassan, a groom, should not have the same name as his father-in-law, nor should the bride, the kala, have the same name as her mother-in-law. These are not mentioned in Shulchan Aruch. I'm sure you've all heard about these issues. Many poskim have wrestled with the issue. How seriously should we take this? You have all kinds of responses. Again, more lenient, less lenient, ways around it. Should we be concerned with Savas Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid? Rabbi Avadya Yosef has two lengthy tshuvas about this, and he's inclined to be lenient, and he compares the situation of Shiduchim, when the young man and woman, of course, have strong feelings toward each other, to a case where two brothers have already been called to the Torah. The second brother has already been brought up, called up, And according to many poskim, in that case, you don't tell him to go down. And therefore, if you already have a relationship, to break it up because of this issue, he says, would be analogous to the case that you don't tell the second brother to go down and you let him go forward. In discussing the situation, Rav Avadya Yosef also says that the power of Ayin Hara is weaker today than in earlier generations. He finds a precedent for such an idea in various achronim, the Yamshel Shlomo, for example, who claims that the Ruach Ra of the Gemara no longer exists nowadays. He also cites the Gemara's statement regarding the superstitious belief of Zugos, that even numbers portend bad luck. The Gemara says, Man dekapit kabdin anrei, one who is more bothered by it has more to be worried about, and the lo kapit, one is less bothered by the belief, lo kapdin anrei, one is less likely to be affected by it. There's a generally balanced approach to the whole issue of Ayin Hara that's found in Rav Moshe's Tshuva, source 22, who was asked about a woman who was pregnant, and to what end should she take precautions of Ayin Hara. So he says, "Be'inyan Ayin Hara, vada yesh lachush, one should be aware of it and somewhat concerned, avol en lahakbid harbe, but no, don't go overboard with it. Keep it varim ka'elu, with matters like this, haklal, the rule is, as we just mentioned before, man de lo kapit lo kapitina bahadeh, the less worried you are, perhaps the less you have to be worried. Kahadim etchina bezugos, that was mentioned regarding that belief in zugos. Avo eini roe bazeh sheisha tzeira shehu kederecha olam lezader, a young woman that normally would get pregnant, sheyeh shayach ayin hara. So a case like that would be less of an issue of ayin hara. With the time that we have left, I guess probably will be the most interesting for many people, but we're not going to be able to deal with it to that extent, is the notion of segulos for Ayin Hara, the possibility of being granted immunity to Ayin Hara. Is such immunity transferable? Is it possible to deflect the power of Ayin Hara by engaging in certain activity? So starting from the Gemara, in numerous places, the Gemara records a tradition that there is one Shevet of the Yud Beis Shvatim, the 12 tribes, that is immune to Ayin Hara. And that's the tribe of Yosef. There are two psukim in Parshas Vayechi that are cited in support. The first is the bracha that Yaakov gives to his grandsons, Ephraim and Menashe. Hamalach Hagoa Osi Mikora. He goes on to say, V'yidgu larov bekerev ha'aretz. They should proliferate like fish within the land. So Yaakov likens Yosef's progeny, Yosef's children, to fish whose extraordinary rate of procreation is attributed to their being hidden from public view. They are under the water, under the radar, and are free from the effects of Ayin Hara. The second source is also in Vayechi, the bracha given to Yosef himself, Bein Poras Yosef, Bein Poras Ali Oyen, a fruitful son, as Rashi takes it, is Yosef. If we're a charming son, a fruitful son to the eye, Ale Oyen is taken as Ole Ayin, ascending or transcending the spell of the evil eye. It's no coincidence that many of the segulos, the remedies that are popularly employed against Ayin Hara, incorporate these two sukim that we mentioned, Hamalach HaGoel Osi and the Pasuk of Bein Poras Yosef. There are many remedies mentioned in the Gemara as schools for Ayin Hara, and some of them seem a little bit bizarre. Some of them are explained in very original ways by the Mefarshim, and we don't have time to go into it. If you look at the literature, there are all kinds of psukim that are mentioned as schools for Ayin Hara. Some people have a practice to say the 11 psukim in Tanakh that begin and end with the letter Nun. Nachnu Navar Chalutzim is one of them, and it's interesting, I didn't see this explicitly, but I imagine this is the idea. Nun, or Nunin, is Aramaic for fish. And as we noted, fish is symbolic of the idea of not being vulnerable to Ayin Hara, so we have that remez as well. We have the Tzukim of Anibar of Chastach of Obeisecha, the Ben Ishchai in Parshas Pinchas, talks about other psukim, Vayisa Vilam Es'ena, Vayaris Yisro Shochim Veshvata, Vatihiyah Lav Ruach Elokim. We all know about that Chamsa. I don't have much to add right now. But I will suggest the following in conclusion. If you're going to talk about Yosef as the symbol of one who's immune to Ayin Hara, and again, many Gemaras speak to that special immunity of Yosef, I think we might do well thinking about Yosef as a personality in the Torah. Now, it's true, when Yosef was young, no question he aroused the envy of his brothers. Parshas Vayeshev, he was telling the dreams to the father, Vayekanu vo echav. His brothers became very jealous. But what happens to Yosef after he's sold as a slave? Something changes in his essence. Yosef becomes completely selfless. And you see this when he comes out of prison and he's standing before Paro, and Paro hails him as a wizard of dream interpretation. I heard about you, you have a way of interpreting dreams. And Yosef's response in his most humble, self-effacing way is, Biladai. It's not about me, Elokim Yana Eshulam Paro. Doesn't want to take the credit for himself. Parshas Vayigash, we read about Yosef as a public servant. Vayava Yosef as a kesef beis Faro. Every last cent that gets accumulated in the coffers of Egypt, of Paro, gets placed over there, and Yosef doesn't take anything for himself. It doesn't come to him. He's doing it for Paro. When Yosef and Yaakov reunite, the Torah says, Vayera Elov, he appeared to him. Rashi explains, Yosef appeared to his father. Explains of Chaim Shmulevitz. Imagine, Yaakov is missing Yosef 22 years, but Yosef is missing his father for 22 years. What's on Yosef's mind? How much it means to him to reunite with Yaakov? No. Vayera Elov. What was on Yosef's mind was how much it means for Yaakov, his father, to reunite with him. He sublimated his own feelings in terms of Yaakov's feelings, thought about what was on Yaakov's mind. And finally, this is really the idea. The Gemara says, why did Yosef get the merit of immunity to Ayin Hara? Because the eye that did not want to feast over that is not his. Ayin Shalom Ratsa Lazlan, B'mash Enu Shalom, will not be affected by Ayin Hara. What does it mean he didn't want to feast his eyes on that which is not his? Rashi says it means the wife of Potiphar. Others say it means the women in Egypt who were gazing at him. He didn't gaze back. But it also may mean in a bigger way. Yosef did not look to take for himself. Yosef looked to give. Yosef hu hamashbir l'chol am ha'aretz. Yosef is a quintessential mashbir. He's the giver. He's not the taker. Perhaps the best immunity we can imagine for Ayin Hara is not this pasuk or that pasuk. There may be merit to all of these segulos. But perhaps the best segula of all is to live in a selfless way, like Yosef HaTzadik, not to look at things as a way of self-promotion, but as really being selfless, to think of others rather than ourselves. And in so doing, like Yosef, we should merit the segula of Ayin Hara. We mentioned that the bracha, Birchas Kohanim, is the school of Ayin Hara. I happen to be a Kohen. I'm not going to bless in a formal sense, but I want to offer the bracha, Yivracha Adonai Bishmeracha, Yoyah Adonai Panav Erecha Vichunacha, Yisar Adonai Panav Erecha Vichim Mecha Shalom. Individually and collectively, we should all be Zocha to only bracha and Hatzlacha in everything that we do.